tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Your host Donna Wolf is in the building with a cool hat on. May I say, Donna?
thank you very much, Ebony.
I like it.
I try to be cool, but I'm more focused on dressing appropriately for the weather. So wool hat, yes.
And Barry Jackson is sitting over here with a new. What do you call it? Look, Barry's rolling his eyes. It looks nice, you all. You can't see it, obviously, but Barry has a new beard. No, his beard, Donna. You didn't recognize
that
Barry
that
has
was?
A new, some new facial hair going on that I'm digging.
This is just lit.
That's Barry Jackson for you. My name is Ebony Johnson. We are delighted to be here this Saturday on the Urban Connection Show. Have a gentleman who's called in from Massachusetts, Penn Lowe, who is the senior lecturer and director of community practice at Tufts University. And he wrote an article that really intrigued me titled "Capitalism is Not the Only Choice." It was in the winter 2017 issue of Yes Magazine. And after I read that article, I reached out to him and he kindly replied and agreed to come on and to discuss this further. Welcome to Urban Connections, Penn.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. So I want to just set a foundation here, as I know for myself and many of us are trained capitalists. And I want to set a foundation of defining some words that we have used for a very long time that maybe have broader definitions than we think. You define and redefine economy. You talk about words like capitalism and solidarity. So can you first start off with what economy is, and then we'll go into what we know or are more familiar with as capitalism, and then progress into solidarity, as you write about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned just from the beginning that we're all trained as capitalists, and that is not by accident.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of our ideas about what economy is that are shaped by capitalism. For instance, competition in markets, right? Sell to the highest bidder, individual ownership. These are all kind of foundational to capitalism. And when you think about economy, though, one of the things that I know really came out of the women's movement was the idea that there's a lot of work that happens that is not paid for and is never really even counted when, you know, government issues figures around the gross domestic product. They don't count domestic work, right? That women do to take care of families, to take care of their household. And it's not only women who do that work, but if it's unpaid, it's not counted. So we like to take a perspective that broadens that, which I think broadens it to something that makes more common sense. So what if we defined economy as everything we do to take care of each other and to meet our material needs? And if you look at it from that point of view, then economy includes a lot more activities that we take part in that aren't necessarily capital.
And so you say some of those, like for instance, the work that unpaid domestic work. I know in a part of the article in Yes Magazine, "Capitalism is Not the Only Choice," you write that economist Nancy Fulbright from University of Massachusetts Amherst estimates that unpaid domestic work, historically considered, quote, women's work, was equal to 26% of the U.S. gross domestic product in 2010.
Yeah, so there have been economists who've been trying to quantify these things, and can't speak to exactly how that figure was put together, but my sense is that it's in the ballpark, and if anything, it might be conservative. I think the other thing when you talk about, and I've had my whole career working with and in lower income communities of color. When you look at all the things that people have to do to survive, there are a lot of things that happen outside the formal economy. And some of those things are perhaps illegal. Not all of the illegal things are necessarily bad. And, you know, there are a lot of things that people have to do to get by, and those things don't really get counted either. You know, so people being paid under the table, for instance.
Right.
And, you know, so there's a lot of things that get left out when you look only at official statistics. Those statistics tend to be built on the formal economy and looking at the economy only through capitalist transactions.
And can you just define based with your research what is capitalism and we'll build from there?
Okay, I'm just going to use a common sense definition. So, capitalism, I think, is a system of economy in which markets where people compete to buy and sell things. And the logic is that, you know, supply will equal demand in the market, and prices will hit a level that merits the level of demand and supply. And I think capitalism is a system in which the logic driving it is that everyone's trying to maximize their individual gain. So profit is the bottom line. And like I said, exchange through markets using money is really the only thing that counts in capitalism. And I would say private property ownership is really the thing that makes all this go. Mm-hmm. You know, so assuming that you have things that you consider private property that you can sell in a market. And I think land is a good example, right? So you have all of these, ideas about, you know, if you own a home, what you can do with that. And, you know, for instance, selling it to the highest bidder is something that you have a right to do as a private property owner under the rules of capitalism. And this is how we get all of the ideas about house flipping and, you know, making profits off of flipping properties and all these shows on TV that cover the folks who do that work. So I would say capitalism is a system of economy, but it is also a political system. So our entire system of governance, the government is set up, in fact, to support these activities. If government wasn't around to have laws that protected people's property, then you couldn't really change them in a reliable way. So government and policy are very much also part of the capitalist system. Some people call it political economy. I would say there's a third dimension to capitalism, which is that it affects our values and how we think. So there's a cultural component to this, right? So I would say a lot of elements of what we consider to be the American dream and ideas about free markets and the rights that people should have and companies should have in free markets, these are all evidence of a cultural component of capitalism.
Penn, this is Donna Wolf. I want to refer to a term you use in the article, capitalocentrism, as you've just described it. And what you're looking for and working towards is an alternative to that where we meet as a society and as a world, we meet our material needs and we care for each other. And this society would be rooted in values of democracy and justice rather than maximizing profit. We'd be taking care of people and taking care of the planet, as you say in your article. Have there ever been societies like that that thrived that we know of now or in the past?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that people who talk about capitalocentrism are trying to do is to, first of all, surface the things that actually are happening that get made invisible. So one of the things that, you know, is part of what I would describe as capitalism exercising its cultural power over our consciousness is that it tells us that there is no alternative, right? That's a phrase that Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan's counterpart in the Great Britain, used a lot, saying there is no alternative to capitalism. You know, just it is what it is and get along. And what that does is it erases all those things that we actually do that aren't exactly capitalism. So trying to address capitalist centralism is really partly just about lifting the veil to show that there are a lot of things and a lot of different kinds of economies that exist now. And also to say that capitalism isn't just one thing, right? So there are a lot of different versions of capitalism and capitalist economies out there. And so when you ask about examples, I think we can point to a lot of different existing examples currently that don't operate exactly by the rules as we know them here in the U.S. You know, and a lot of people who talk about solidarity economies, new economies, will point to formations like the Mondragon cooperatives mm-hmm. in the Basque region of Spain. Right? These have been a network of worker-owned cooperatives that have been in operation since the 1950s. And they've grown to such an extent. This is no small enterprise. We think about worker co-ops here, and typically it's the bike shop with three or four people. In Mondragon, we're talking about 200 different businesses that employ over 70,000-80,000 people. It can be at a much larger scale. And the idea that workers own their own companies, have an equal say, so a democratic process to make decisions, is really counter to our ideas of what capitalism means here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But yet we have an example where Mondragon has been in existence for more than half a century, and it competes in the global marketplace. You can buy washing machines and bicycles and auto parts made by Mondragon.
Could you go in a little more detail? I'm familiar with the Mondragon experience. I remember seeing a documentary about how the people of the Mondragon region of Spain put that together. Was that how much of that had more to do with their desire to maintain their culture and language?
It had a lot to do with that. So I think one of the reasons why I tend to use the word solidarity economy when I talk about alternatives to capitalism is that the idea that we're all in this together and that we need to have solidarity with one another and we need to work together is really at the center of what made Mondragon Mondragon. And yes, of course, what they saw in common with each other was their culture, their language, their history. This is the Basques,
right?
Who are not, they don't speak Spanish. They're in their own kind of ethnicity with their own history, and they were oppressed within the Spanish regime. So that did help them to have a sense of solidarity, but that's not the only way to build solidarity. And so I think, we can learn a lot from places like Mondragon to say that when people come together in common cause and say we're in this together, there are, I would say that that's an asset and a strength that can be built upon. In capitalism, it's all about the individual, right? It's what did the one person do and what does that one person gain and win? Mm-hmm. In the marketplace, but I think especially those of us who, many of us who are not from, who are in communities that are struggling, right? We know that it's about our survival is about how well we can work together,
yeah.
And I think that's what the folks in Mondragon really have proven is that when you can come together like that, it does make a difference, and you can even compete with the multinational capitalist corporation.
Now, Penn, a part of that article as well in Yes Magazine, for our listeners who are just tuning in here on Urban Connections at 90.1 FM, we're talking with Penn Lowe, Senior Lecturer and Director of Community Practice at Tufts University, who wrote an article about capitalism, saying capitalism is not the only choice. And in that article, you list examples of how what you refer to as solidarity, meaning, like you said, us coming together and having different ways of meeting our needs that work better for some of us. You say that solidarity is rising, and you list some examples, specifically the Wellspring Initiative, other examples. Can you speak to some of those examples that are actually happening across the U.S. now?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The examples that I raise are the ones that I'm most closely connected to in the work that I do here, starting in the Boston area, but also connected to efforts, like you said, across Massachusetts. They tend to be urban examples. I'll say a little bit about a few of these, but I also want to caution that, that sometimes people get the impression that these things are only happening in urban communities of color, and that's actually not the case. I think you can see signs that people are trying to do these things basically everywhere. And there are a lot of areas in rural America where have been struggling for decades and decades with economic development as well, and they're looking to similar strategies. But the Wellspring Initiative, which was featured heavily in the Yes article, this is an example based in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield is the third largest city in Massachusetts. It's a post-industrial city that has not been enjoying the kinds of success that Boston has. So it has a very challenged economy. And here, a number of folks came together and said, what if we were to create a network of worker-owned cooperatives that could be in businesses that would help provide goods and services to the region's universities and hospitals, what people call anchor institutions, right? So unlike other manufacturing industries that could pick up and move to areas with lower worker costs, these anchor institutions basically are there to stay. And so these folks did some of their homework, and they found that there were billions of dollars of being spent by the region's universities and hospitals, and said, you know, we can capture part of that. You know, how much of that is being procured locally? And on top of that, how much is being procured from businesses that are actually owned by people who live in the community, by the workers themselves? So they embarked on that vision. They didn't create that vision from scratch on their own. They were inspired by the Evergreen Cooperative that had launched out of Cleveland about 15 years ago. The folks in Cleveland were inspired by Mondragon in Spain. So, you know, these ideas have been circulating, and they've been hopping from continent and from place to place. But in Wellspring, they formed first an upholstery co-op, and the idea was they could help provide reupholstering needs for these different institutions, for all the dorms and for the hospital furniture and such. And they actually partnered with their county prison, which had a very successful and long-standing worker training program that had a focus on upholstery. They're just in the process of now opening up a greenhouse that is going to grow vegetables for the local school system, and that's a venture that they had to raise almost $1 million in startup capital just to get going. But they've also helped incorporate into this network some existing businesses that converted to worker ownership. So Old Windows Workshop was a woman-owned firm that renovated old windows, and she decided worker ownership was the best path forward for her business and for the workers that she has. And so they're now also part of the Wellspring Network. So Wellspring is underway with several businesses, and they continue to talk with and help incubate other efforts. And WellSpring is one of a handful of different efforts across the country which are taking what is called the anchor institution strategy that was modeled by the Cleveland Co-op. So that's one example. But I want to say that, so that was a pretty well-organized example in which there was an intention from the beginning to create a whole network and to support that. But in other places, for instance, in Boston, what I've seen is that you kind of have a system coming together based on a lot of people trying to do different things related to each other, and they're finding each other and trying to figure out how to form their own networks and economic system. So in the food sector here, there are folks in Boston who are trying to figure out how to grow locally on the vacant land that we've got in the city. They're trying to figure out how they can sell that to local catering companies and cafes that are opening up and serving the community. There's folks who are then trying to figure out how to compost the food waste that comes out of these institutions and turn that back into soil that we can return to the land. So these are examples where it's not centrally coordinated, but just lots of folks are trying to do things that they think make sense and that they can develop businesses that are community-owned and governed in some way and that they think will provide benefits for people in the community and good jobs. So it's happening a lot of different ways. And in the immigrant community in Boston, we're seeing similar desires where people are saying, you know what, we're not getting access to the good jobs. We are at the same time being gentrified out of our neighborhood. How can we stay? And to do that, we need a solid economic base. Can we build our own economic base with our own companies that are worker co-ops? And so the Center for Cooperative Development and Solidarity in East Boston, which is primarily Latina immigrant women, they're trying to support each other to figure out how to do this. And they've got a child care co-op, sewing co-op, and a cleaning co-op underway, under development. So these things are, you know, people are trying to do these things, and they're trying to do that in a community context. And I would emphasize, too, that it's not just starting businesses that are democratically governed and collectively owned. There's also a lot of work happening to try to change the policies and the rules of the game. So there's organizing that has to go along with all of those in order to create the space so that there's a more level playing field for these types of businesses to be able to.
This is Donna again, Penn. You talk about the need for us to make choices, conscious decisions about how we're going to be as consumers, where we're going to work, what we are going to produce, where we're going to live. And you mention choice about whether or not you want to work for a for-profit entity owned by shareholders, or if you want to work for a worker-owned cooperative, a nonprofit, or a B corporation. Can you explain what a B corporation is? I think everybody's pretty much heard of C corporations and subchapter S corporations and LLCs and all that stuff. What is a B corporation?
A B corporation is just a benefit corporation that is not all states have them, but in states that have that designation, it just says that you are legally bound to create some type of social benefit as part of your work. So you're, as unlike other corporations where they're bound to serve the interests of purely the interests of their shareholders or owners, there's also a social and community benefit component to it. So that's all that is. And so part of this is to say that there's a lot of different types of business formations that are being innovated in part to try and get at, people call it sometimes the triple bottom line. Right? So instead of in addition to profit, we also hear about the environment, we hear about community and workers. So the B Corp is just one form, legal form, to make that happen and to keep folks accountable to it.
Thank you for that. We are going to take a station break here. And when we come back, we'll hear more with Professor Pin Low, a senior lecturer and director of community practice with Tufts University here on the Urban Connection Show. We are talking about alternatives to capitalism. And feel free to call in and join in on the discussion and ask questions or even state maybe some of the things that you're doing in your own communities and families and homes at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534, and we will be back after these messages.
If you have a car, boat, or truck you no longer need, you can donate it to KKFI, which helps your favorite radio station and gets you a tax deduction. Call Bill at 816-994-7869.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Back here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, the Urban Connection Show. Your host, Donna Wolf, is in the building. Co-host Barry Jackson and myself, Ebony Johnson. We are live having the distinguished pleasure of talking with Pin Low, Senior Lecturer and Director of Community Practice at Tufts University, about alternatives to capitalism. What if capitalism is not the only choice? And clearly it is not, based on what other folks are doing. Donna, you have a...
Again, give us a call here in the studio if you'd like to join in our conversation. 816-931-5534, 816-931-KKFI. And I have another question or a statement. Yeah, question for Penn. Ebony just played Superstition by Stevie Wonder, and I think the operative link there was, when you believe in things that you don't understand, you suffer. Can you tell us how we are getting hypnotized into so much belief and buy into this capitalist system? I think sometimes it helps to be aware of the mechanisms that make you believe certain things, even though you don't see the strings being pulled.
Yeah, that's... Thanks for asking that.
It's pervasive.
Sometimes not easy, and sometimes it's very easy.
Yeah.
You know? But I would say, you know, capitalism, as I mentioned earlier, has both an economic dimension, right? So there are real examples you can point to where people are doing things in a capitalist way. And there are things many of us have to do on a day-to-day basis where we are also participating in that system, economic system, right? So that's one dimension where it reinforces these ideas about capitalism, is that we actually have to participate in them. You know, if you don't have enough cash in your pocket and you've got to figure out how to put food on your table, right, you're going to buy what you can afford. You know, that's kind of how the market works in that instance. There's also a political dimension, right? So we're in a supposed democracy, and there's lots of policies that get passed that basically tilt the tables towards more capitalist practices and supports, the corporations that are making profits off of this system. And again, sometimes we may not agree or like what those policies do, but they're happening. And all of these things, the economic and political dimensions, are backed by powerful ideas that are sometimes hard to shake. And I think this is what you're getting to, some of those superstitions that, these forces are too powerful, that everything's always going to be driven to the bottom line in terms of who has the most money. And the interests that are served by that, right? So that's why I think, in part, sometimes it's easy to see it. It's all around us all the time. And I referenced reality TV because there's, so many, from Shark Tank to those house-flipping shows. There's all kinds of things where you're basically glorifying a lot of these capitalist practices. And these start to get reinforced with the actual political and economic systems that we have to be a part of. So it's not an easy thing to say that we're simply going to unplug ourselves from that, because that's not the reality for most people. But at the same time, I think part of what we're trying to do through the article and the work that I've been doing with community groups is to say that, there are things that we can do. There are things that we can start to build. There are economic assets that we can start to control and grow that come from our own work and in our own community. And that these things are rooted in a lot of things that our communities have learned how to do in order to survive. So these aren't completely brand new things. These are building on the kinds of mutual support people have provided to each other on an informal basis. These are built on the kinds of community organizing that has been happening in marginalized communities. This is built on some of the great examples of community building that has been happening in the real world. So these things can be countered, but we have to counter it both at the level of what we think and how we feel about it, as well as the actual economic institutions and the policies that are involved.
Having had a little bit of experience of trying to explain cooperatives to people in the urban setting, I noticed there was a little bit of reticence on the part of people, because it was, I guess, for whatever reason, they felt it was just kind of hard to grasp because we've lived under a capitalist system for so long. But would you agree or disagree that probably one of the prime examples is what farmers have been doing for decades upon decades and pooling their resources together so they can buy seed, buy equipment, and get their goods to market.
Absolutely. Farmers have been doing collective production strategies, and producer co-ops are a very well-established thing among farmers. So, I don't know a huge amount about it, but I do know that there's a very, very long tradition of cooperativism among Black farmers, particularly in the South, was partly a survival strategy too.
Well, I think one of the things that a lot of people see, especially when they're traveling and they travel through rural communities and they stop at gas stations or whatever, and they'll see those big, I don't know if they're columns or what they are, and you see the word co-op written on them. Mm-hmm. And, find out that, a seed store or whatever, the farmers in that community have joint ownership in that particular business. So,
yeah,
I think
that's
what I was referring to.
These are also examples that don't necessarily get lifted up, but they are real life examples that have been in existence for a long time. They're important institutions serving their communities. I think put a little bit of caution on is that just because you have the form of a cooperative doesn't necessarily mean that you're functioning always as a cooperative, right? So, and that's the same, with any form doesn't always dictate function. So, it's great that there are a lot of these different forms that are out there, but we also have to take a closer look at how they actually are functioning. And, are they living up to the values of democratic governance that they might say they are? And we know it's the same thing like with nonprofits, right? Nonprofits are supposed to be mission-oriented, and not all of them are, but they can be called to account on it, and I think it's the same with the cooperative sector.
And, Penn, we have a caller. Caller, please state your name, where you're calling from.
Yeah, I'm Darnell Hunt, and Olathe, Kansas.
Hey, Darnell.
How you doing there?
Good.
Yeah, I just tuned in. I got in my car, and I tuned in and heard the subject matter. As an alternative, definitely cooperatives, I think, is the way to go as far as democratizing the enterprise. And I heard the guest state that, there's issues with how it's being ran and that and governed. And that's the same with capitalism. I guess we'd have to regulate it and ensure that things are being done the way they're prescribed. And that's the only way to ensure that, we get democracy within the system, because we definitely don't have it in capitalism. And I don't know if your guest is pro-capitalist or not, because I just tuned in, but it kind of seemed like he was the way he was talking. But I want to, after making that comment, have you ever heard of a resource-based society? I know it's far-fetched, but to me it seems like the way to go. I have the saying that nobody brought anything to this earth, and we don't take anything with us, but we create a lot of hell in between trying to own stuff and taking away from people. And one of my big problems with capitalism is that it's predicated on taking advantage of people. Thus, with this country and the enslavement of people, so that folks can make money. So I'm going to go ahead and let you comment on that.
Thanks, Darnell. I just want to first dispel the notion that I am a pro-capitalist. But the whole point of today's segment is about a piece I wrote on how capitalism is not the only choice. And things like co-ops are part of what I see as transformative strategies that we can go beyond capitalism. I really appreciate your how you framed the resource-based society, because I think a lot of what I'm seeing emerging out of community efforts to build solidarity economy is in fact what you're talking about, right? It's overcoming the capitalist idea that we have to turn everything into individually owned private property, right? And, you know, one of the things that I've been doing a lot of work with here in Boston neighborhoods is the idea of community land trust. Right, so the idea that everybody owns land and have a home on it, can sell it to whoever they want at the highest, whoever comes bidding the highest for it. Community land trusts kind of split the ownership. They say community owns the land, and then the homeowner can own the house. Right, so the ownership of the land is collective and is governed by a community entity that can decide for itself what is in the best interest of the community in terms of development. But then it can set rules so that if they think that permanently affordable housing is one of the things that they want their land to support, then yes, you can own your home on top of that land, but you're restricted in terms of what you can sell it for. And the other thing is you can never sell your home to a speculator, right, who's going to say turn your modest affordable home into high-priced condos. Right. So in fact, there are strategies that folks are taking in the solidarity economy movement to basically collectivize ownership, and they're doing it in some very interesting ways, where it isn't just public or government ownership, but it's collective in that there are different community entities with different levels of democratic governance that are controlling those.
Gotcha. Do you think the capitalists will ever buy into that? Obviously, you know, when people have wealth and power, they don't want to release it. And another thing I want to add, when I tuned in, you were talking about, you know, people who have power and money. And the other thing that keeps capitalism alive and well is might, as in military might, if you will.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's totally connected to the systems of power. So some of these strategies are taking hold.
I'm going to interrupt here, Darnell. I just want to say thanks for the call. Penn can keep going. We're just going to clear the line in case anyone else wants to call in. But thanks, Darnell, for the call. We appreciate you for tuning in and participating.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Professor Penn.
Yeah. So I think addressing the power issue is really something that I've been trying to call out, because, again, I the way I see this solidarity economy movement and transformation happening, it's not just getting these types of cooperative businesses going. We need those, but we need to create more space and resources for that to happen. And to do that, we need to take back government. We need to take back control of the public resources that are basically, as I was saying before, tilting the playing field towards the capitalist enterprises, and we need to tilt them back towards things that are more based in cooperativism and democratic control. So that will require a fight, and Darnell's right. The folks who have power and wealth aren't necessarily going to give that up easily, but that's where we've got to organize, and we've got to build political power. And we've got to do that at the same time that we're trying to build some of these alternatives.
Thank you. We have another caller. Pink caller, please state your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, Steve, Kansas City North.
Hi, Steve. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, it's a great show, great topic. I would like to point out that there's a growing movement called democratic eco-socialism, which recognizes that socialism in the past has not really addressed some of the issues that we're seeing now that are causing climate change, which is the growth in the use of carbon products. And eco-socialism is a democratic, not a state-run type of socialism like the Soviet Union, but one that is, you know, egalitarian, democratic, and based on a common good and protecting and owning the commons.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much, Steve. Did you have...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I appreciate you bringing the S word into the into the discussion, socialism. You know, I think I'm someone who came of age in the Reagan presidency and, you know, went through a period where the whole idea that there was a capitalism versus communism type of, you know, global battle kind of was kind of went away. And I think we're entering a period now where, you know, the ideas behind socialism are very much the same ones that we're talking about here with solidarity economy. And but a very big difference in that it's not the state-centered socialism that we've seen.
Exactly.
And that has not necessarily done a whole lot, particularly on the environment, you know, in terms of being any better. So so I appreciate bringing that in because there are a lot of folks for whom, you know, ideas about socialism are still very real. And the kinds of democratic eco-socialism you're talking about, I think, are really part of the same discussion that we're having here.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for tuning in. Professor Penn, I also want to talk about three things that you say we must confront if we want to transform and go beyond capitalism. You say we in all three of these dimensions, consciousness, power, and economy. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, actually we've spoken about all three of those things during the conversation today, in order, you know, in order to make those transformations. And you've been a part of another study with let me get her, the other professor that want to make sure I get her name right, Sarah Jimenez, Solidarity Rising in Massachusetts, How Solidarity Economy Movement is Emerging in Lower Income Communities of Color. And some of the, you give it, you know, list examples of how nonprofits play critical roles in providing incubation resources and organizing and building the base and doing research models, and how different types of businesses and organizations in and of itself are coming together, you know, to make some of these things happen. But you do say that you want us to see, one of the things, the recommendations from that report is seeing solidarity economy holistically as a transformative social movement, and then joining up the building of alternatives with resist and reform efforts, being willing to innovate and be prepared to fail forward, take an ecosystem approach to building and scaling up, supporting core organizations and incubation infrastructure, and inspiring and connect initiatives so that we learn from one another and scale up. And you also talk about building the solidarity finance sector with funders and investors who see themselves as a part of and not apart from the movement. Can you speak more to some of these recommendations, including some of the ones, like you said, overcoming the mindset of capitalism, including skepticism, that alternatives are even possible?
Yeah, I'll start with that one because I think in part of the work that I had hoped the Yes Magazine article would do was to raise more discussion and getting people talking about, you know, what are the possibilities. So even this radio show, I think, is part of that work. To challenge the ideas that were handed down from capitalism, and to say, you know, if we open our eyes and see the things that are actually happening, you know, how do we start to think about making change towards that? If we can have people not just say, yeah, that's a great thing, but it's never going to happen, but to say, you know what, that's a great vision, and here are a couple of things we can start doing now. That's I think, what the work is going to be on the consciousness side. On the power building side, you know, this builds on what we were just talking about with Darnell, which is that, you know, to get these types of efforts going, we're going to have to reform the system and take back some of the public resources to actually support these types of solidarity economy initiatives. And finally, the third thing is to help build these alternatives. You know, can we build some of these alternatives while you know, everything else is still happening. And if we can do all three of these things together, then I think we have a formula for transformation, and it's the same formula that at least in my understanding, it's the same formula for success of past social movements, whether that be the civil rights movement or the labor movement. You know, all of these movements change people's minds in a very fundamental way about what the world should be and what our role is in it. They all were about taking political power, and they were about trying to change the ways that our economy worked. So I think we need to take a page out of some of those past movements that we know to have made tremendous progress. And I think all three of those dimensions are critical, and they work together. So I think one of the things that is important to note, though, is that it's not easy to do all this stuff, given how interwoven we are into capitalism. And I'll just give one example, which is from my own experience working in community-based nonprofits, right, where we have to compete for funding, where funders oftentimes are adopting the same types of approaches as capitalism, saying, you know, you've got to compete, you've got to have your metrics, what's your return on investment, and all this stuff. So that even the nonprofits that are trying to do this mission-based work themselves sometimes get caught up in the web of capitalism and trying to show, you know, how they are producing so-called return and profit. And when you are funded that way, it can really put your own handcuffs on in terms of what you're able to do and how you're able to even dream about what kind of future is possible. And when I was working in an environmental justice space, community-based organization, and we were part of a coalition to help advocate for green jobs. You know, we knew how to do the policy work, and we were successful here in Massachusetts, as were people all over the country, to get, for instance, higher standards for climate change emissions and to put public resources towards energy efficiency and renewable energy, right? So we knew how to do that type of policy work, reform work. But then we asked ourselves the question, well, okay, so we've won these things, and now we've created essentially new markets. Like, who's going to deliver those energy efficiency and tap into all the funds that are now available? Right? Who's going to build the renewable energy systems that are now demanded by policy? And that's when we started to focus on the economic side. We said, well, we can't just wait for people to come in and do these things and then hope that they hire people in our community, hope that they, you know, pay a decent wage. Are there possibilities for us to actually create our own companies to do these things? And that's what, for me, starting about 10 years ago, started our path towards asking some of these questions about, you know, what are the alternatives that are possible? So I guess I just recount that story to say that, you know, there's a lot of dimensions of work that need to be happening here, from helping to expose people and change their minds to doing the policy work to actually getting some of these alternative enterprises off the ground. And it's a lot of work, but I think it's worth doing. And there's so many experiments and innovations going on out there right now. I can't even keep track of them all because there's so many people everywhere who are trying to do these things. And that to me is a sign of hope.
Well, that's good news to hear. We have been speaking with Pin Low, Senior Lecturer and Director of Community Practice at Tufts University, about his winter article, the winter 2017 article in Yes Magazine titled Capitalism is Not the Only Choice. And he's been gracious enough to give us some examples of alternatives as well as some ideas and challenges that we face. So, Pin, can you please give people, you have a personal website website with different articles and resources and information. Can you please give the address to that for people who want to follow your work and know more about what you're up to?
Sure. My Practical Visionaries blog site is at PennLo, it's all one word, and my entire name, which is PennLoh.wordpress.com. And you should be able to reach that if you just Google my name, and if you can find it through Tufts University as well.
All right. Thanks for that. And as we close here, I would like to remind everyone of Arthur and Pulitzer Prize winner Alice Walker's famous statement, "The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any." And power to the people, if you will, huh, Donna and Barry?
Power to the people.
You know, thanks so much again, PennLo. We appreciate the conversation and look forward to staying in touch with you and then the work that you're doing as well, and hope to maybe have you on again.
I would very much appreciate that. Thanks so much for having me. Great to talk to you, Ebony and Donna and Barry. It's been a pleasure.
Look forward to some time when we can get you here.
Someday, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Thanks so much again. You've been tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, on the Urban Connection Show. Please stay tuned for Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson, and after that, Roots Wise Reggae with Rockin' Donna. We'll be right back.